Love Talk Radio.
Mike Dugan here tonight. I am flying solo. Unfortunately, my good friend and co-host, Mike Galliano, his dad fell yesterday off a ladder and did some, pretty good damage. He fractured his skull. So Mike has been at the hospital all day yesterday and all day today. And his dad is a little beat up. So to our listeners out there in Fire Engineering Radio Land, I want to thank you all for listening to us either live or in archives. And I would also like to say a little prayer for Mikey G's dad and just wish him well in a quick and speedy recovery, because those things are tough, especially the older we get, the less we bounce, as I myself can attest to. So joining me tonight is going to be my good friend, Bobby Halton. Bobby's the editor of Fire Engineering Magazine, and he's also a very, very close friend of mine and Mike's, and I know that he is going to be saying a prayer for Mike's dad also. We're going to talk tonight with Bobby about critical decision-making as we start going through tonight's show. Bobby, how are you, my brother?
Very good, Michael. Thank you for having me on, and my best to Mike and his family. I hope his dad has a speedy recovery.
Yeah, it's going to be, I think it's going to be a tough blow from what I understand, and it's only been very, very brief texts back and forth, but his dad fell off the ladder. He fractured his skull, and he's beat up pretty good. So, yeah. And you and I both know the older we get, the less we bounce. We tend to bruise more the older we get. So it's not fun. And we wish him well.
Absolutely. Well, it's good to have you on the phone here, buddy.
Yeah, it's great to be on the phone.
I feel like we should be in an Italian restaurant in New York.
Oh, yeah. Our favorite place, 1019. Place Bobby's mom, for those of you who don't know how small a real world it really is, Bobby's mom lives around the corner from me with his brother Ray, and his sister also teaches at the high school that my daughter will graduate from this year. So it is a small world, and you really don't know. And I met Bobby when we were on the road together, and he was, at that time, we were still in Albuquerque?
Yeah, I was still in Albuquerque, yep.
Yep. He was still in the operations chief in Albuquerque and when we met, and it was just a very, very strange thing to be able to, have a guy he comes into all the time to see his mom, and it's also nice for him, and it's nice for all of us as brothers to know that he has a friend and a brother close by. If he needs help, I can be his eyes and his ears right away.
Yeah, I sure do appreciate it, especially when the weather hits and mom being 88 years old. So it's always a comfort to know that you got a brother down the block that can drop in and bail her out when she needs bailing out.
Yep, Yeah, and the weather is pretty interesting here this evening. We've got a nor'easter, but it's staying off shore tonight. We're getting, the winds have been crazy. We're getting 50, 60-mile-an-hour gusts tonight. And then it was supposed to snow, but I think they've taken that out of the forecast. And the snow will be a secondary storm where it loops around behind the storm and comes in tomorrow night. And we're supposed to get 5 or 6 inches of snow tomorrow night. So, March storms, man, you never know. So, what's that?
In like a lion, out like a lamb. March.
Yep. Oh, it's great, man. Spring is around the corner. Spring is around the corner. We are going to talk tonight with Bobby about, we're going to do some discussions about critical decision making and how it relates to the fire service. But before we start that, we have to have a quick word from our sponsor. Grainger has agreed to sponsor these things, so please spend the next 31 seconds listening to Grainger.
With an industry-leading distribution network, Grainger can save you tons of downtime by offering over 900,000 products, many ready to ship right when you need them. In fact, 99% of items ordered ship same day. So fast, the International Acronym Committee is considering changing ASAP to ASAG, or as soon as Grainger. At least they would be considering it if there were such a committee. To help keep your business running efficiently, call clickgrainger.com or stop by a branch today. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So now that we've started paying the bills, hey, listen, right. If this is what it takes to keep talk radio, the blog talk radio with Fire Engineering up and running, I'm all for it. Because they're going to help us pay the bills and bring the word to all the brothers and sisters out there in fire engineering land, which I think is a good, good thing.
And they really are a great company. And with all the belt tightening going on today, that's a great place to get your equipment. They got great prices, great shipping. They have GSA contracts. They got everything. They got everything you need to put on the fire truck except the fire truck. And when they say they got 900,000 products, they mean it. And they move them. I went to their headquarters out there in Chicago. Impressive operation. Great people. A lot of vets working there. Just a great operation, great bunch of people, and they also help us with the honor guard competition at FDIC. That absolutely doesn't make 2 cents, and so firefighters should definitely support Grainger because Grainger's definitely all about supporting us. So they got my vote. But let's talk a little bit about decision making, Mike.
Good. Let's talk a little bit about critical decision making. Critical decision making, can you define it for our listeners? Can you tell these men and women out there listening live tonight and also men and women who are going to be listening to this in archive what it is? But first, let me just say, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, feel free to call in. The number is 1-760-454-8852. To speak with Bobby, or if you would like to, you can write us a little note on the Blog Talk Radio chat window, and I will get to it as soon as I see it. So, Bobby, tell us about the critical decision making.
Well, I think that it's important that we define it anything before we start talking about it. And when we talk about critical decision making, there's a certain context that brings up, and what that brings up is time pressures, limited information, high risk, and limited resources. So that pretty much defines the fire ground, no matter how you split the hairs. But that's what's always defined critical decision making. The science of it goes back forever. Plato and Socrates and before them, Ptolemy and people like that have studied decision making since man began making decisions. And the real modern, if you will, version of it back in the 40s, the Army started looking at creating programs to help to try to improve during World War II how field combat commanders could make better decisions, with limited resources, severe time constraint, pressure, and high risk. And they came up with an acronym called GOFER, which was goals, objectives, or goals, options. And they thought that you would go look at a situation, then run through a list of alternatives, select the best alternative, try to make it work, and then if it didn't, you know, revise your plan. The problem with that was that's not how we really think. And here's where it gets a little sticky. Today, you have a lot of guys going around the country teaching classes on recognition-prime decision-making or situational awareness, and they say that they're going to help you increase your situational awareness or improve your critical incident decision-making. And that's all well and good, and we can, but you can't teach situational awareness, nor can you teach RPD. But what you can do is have people practice in context and try to help them become more comfortable making decisions in context by getting them more used to pressure. But that has its limitations also, and we'll talk about that in a moment. The other thing you can do is give them a wider variety of situations. So when we talk about critical incident decision-making from the military perspective and the fire service perspective, we've borrowed a lot of our modern thought on it from the military because of the military science with it. And some of that has to do with crew resource management, which I'm going to kind of tie in at the end, but in a kind of unusual format, if you will, not in the classic sense of CRM as the people who, you know, like Dane Carley and folks like that teach it, who do a great job. They have a more traditional handle on it than I'm going to speak about tonight. I'm talking about a little more modern dynamic version of it tonight. So some of the basic points that every firefighter needs to be aware of when we talk about critical decision-making and how it works at a fire would be this, is that we do have a system called recognition prime decision-making. And basically, Mike, what that is that's how we make decisions. In other words, we'll see any situation. Say we're driving our cars and we pull up to an intersection. Well, when we first started driving, we would look right, look left, look at the other cars, you know, wait till the light turned, and we pretty much did everything by rote. You know, we had an algorithm that we were following or a methodology that we were taught in driver's ed, and we stuck to it because we really weren't experts yet. We were novices, so we were very rule-driven. Now, if you pull up to the intersection, you know, you could be thinking about heading out to the firehouse. You could be thinking about doing the drill on the warthog. You could be thinking in the back of your mind about building the porch for your wife. You could be having all these thoughts going through your mind. But suddenly, you'll notice that the wheels on the car in the lane on the right-hand side of you are slightly edged to the left, and it gives you the indication that you know they're going to be making a left-hand turn without even looking for their blinker. You'll notice that there's a car coming down in your rearview mirror. You'll take all of this in because over time you've developed an expertise. You're able to recognize a lot of more nuance and a lot more subtlety. And that's what some of the modern sets and reps people are trying to do with some of the simulations. In other words, build that ability to recognize more and more subtle cues so that you can make more decisions. What recognition prime decision making is all about is recognizing those subtle cues. That triggers a model in your head that you've seen before, and that makes you anticipate a particular next item, if you will, and that gives you the opportunity to react. The flaw in RPD, in recognition prime decision making, that we're finding today is that it falls apart in situations that we've never encountered before, in anomaly-type situations. The other problem with RPD, if you will, is that it's really limited to your initial thought process, and it doesn't carry over into the higher context stuff. So now what we know, and a lot of this we get from the work of Daniel Kahneman, if you want to read a good book on how we make decisions, it's called Thinking Fast and Slow, is that now we know that there are really two systems that work on the fire ground as regards to making decisions. The first is RPD, or recognition prime decision making, which you cannot teach. You can tell people about how it works with pattern recognition, and you can help people recognize more patterns. But RPD is not a teachable skill. Everybody already knows it. Everybody already does it. The second part of it is what Kahneman calls is system two thinking, or higher thinking, where we actually do start weighing options, and we actually do start evaluating things at a much higher level. And if you think about the human brain, the cerebral cortex is the front part of our brain, much younger. That's where we process things like humor, higher thought. The amygdala, the lower part of our brain, or what people call the lower systems, it's more emotional, it's more pattern matching, it's where fear is processed. That's really where we do a lot of this. The initial RPD stuff comes in, is cue recognition. And it happens in milliseconds. What's fascinating, Mike, about RPD, though, and what they've found is that when it comes to making initial decisions, almost 90% of the time, maybe a little higher, the person is right. In other words, you'll make the right decisions. The flaw comes when we start to talk about pattern recognition, and they proved this with Air Force pilots. They ran a simulator, and they had a landing deal, and they told them that they were going to be practicing landings into wind conditions on shortened runways. They gave them a load of bull. But what they did was they kept running the simulation over and over and got used to that pattern, and then they placed a Southwest Airlines jet at the end of the runway, obstructing their landing, and I'm not sure the exact number, but I believe it was in the high 40s or 50s percentile-wise, flew right into it. Because your patterns will fail you. All a pattern tells you, or a model, is what's true about the model. It doesn't tell you what's not true about the model, and that's what pattern recognition can get us into trouble. A lot of people might be familiar with the Invisible Gorilla video that's very popular by the people from VizCognition. There's a great book out called The Invisible Gorilla that was written by the two gentlemen who came up with that initial video. And if you go to their website, you can buy a CD of a dozen or so of those vignettes where they change something in the middle of it and you never recognize it because it doesn't fit your pattern. So basically what we're talking about on the fire ground in terms of decision making now we know are two systems. The first system, the initial system, being pattern recognition, and the second system being higher thought and more complicated decision making. Where we really need to talk about it, moving away from the science, let's talk about some of the practical aspects of it, is what does this mean to us in terms of training, obviously, which is what Mike and I are passionate about at this point in our careers, and then actually operating at the fire. And I think what we'd like to understand then is that, and this is very critical, is that RPD is going to fail us at some juncture in our decision making. In other words, RPD is good for initial stuff, but then when things get more complicated and more unique, it tends to fall apart. And the second thing is that we have what's called 6 bits of workable memory when we're under pressure. And that's just a scientific term for an amount. But basically it boils down to you can make 4 or 5 decisions under high stress, and then you're pretty much done. You really don't have the ability to go too much further. And we've all seen this when somebody seems to just check out, if you will, or become detached from the scene because they just can't make any more decisions. And the value of knowing this means that now we can move forward and start talking intelligently about what we should be doing on the fire ground. And in Klingberg's book, another great book, and I love books, called The Overflowing Brain, he's a neuroscientist and a scientist, and he basically has proven that we have very limited capacity under pressure in order to handle the inflow of information. And the problem is that with today's communications abilities and everything else, we have so much information flowing in at us. So, Mike, if it's okay, can we talk about the fire ground and what all this means in terms of, the first arriving, second arriving?
Oh, absolutely. That's where, I mean, to me, Bobby, that's where the rubber meets the road with this. And this is where the people who come and listen to us, the movers and shakers in the fire service who want to know what's going on, this is where they want to know about it. Because I know a lot of this came from the military, and the fire service has adapted it. And it's a great, great tool. But if you don't know how to use the tool, you're just going to look like a fool out there. So please tell us about the
you know, the first arriving and how to adapt it on the fire ground as a first in officer, as a firefighter, as the second in, please.
Okay. Well, I think there's a couple of things that we need to talk about that have long been sacred cows that we need to slaughter right away. The first one is that I don't think in every system it's necessary that the first two assumes command. And by command, let me define command. In other words, say, you know, this is such and such at the corner, walk and don't walk, and I've got a two-story residential with pink trim and, you know, fire showing on the second floor and a fountain in the yard and all the on and on and on. I think that the first two needs to learn how to do an accurate size up and look for as many cues, if you will, as he possibly can to let the rest of the alarm know. So I think that some of what we're doing with the sets and reps and with the simulations, I think all of that is excellent for cue recognition, because the more cues that we can identify, the easier it is for folks coming in behind us to really know what we have. So that being said, I don't believe that it's necessarily the best idea to put that person in command, if you will. The other problem with that is, and in almost every system I know, we have an understanding between the units, first do, second do, third do, if not written procedures and policies, for what they're to do at a standard operating fire, a residential house fire, two-story, a walk-up, high-rise, standalone commercial, churches, assemblies, factories. You know, we generally have something in writing for our first due responsibilities. So that's the second part of the puzzle, while we're slaughtering a sacred cow. But for years, starting back in the late 70s, it was decided by folks that really didn't have a military background that the first due should assume command, and then you have a centralized figure who's in control of the incident. Well, when you roll up first due and you size it up, you've really kind of set the tone. You've put the tactical objective. By assuming command and then having to give subsequent orders to second arriving units, that might well work well in the classroom, but we know in context, and we know from how the brain works in our earlier discussion, that it's really not reasonable to put that kind of pressure on somebody unnecessarily. The other part of the puzzle is, if there's a higher-ranking person, like, say, a Mike Duden or a Mike Galliano, who are trained battalion chiefs in the art of managing multiple companies, we should probably leave that responsibility there rather than pushing it down onto someone who's not trained at that level and who doesn't have that responsibility. Now, I'm not saying that the chief should be giving direct orders or do this or go there or do this, but they should be listening for the cues so that if they hear something that doesn't fit the pattern or something abnormal, they can add advice, they can stop an action, or they can intercede, or they can reaffirm and confirm and thereby support. And there's the crux of what I wanted to talk about tonight. Critical incident decision-making has a system, RPD, for its initial stuff. Then it moves into higher functioning decision-making, which we would look at as really what the chiefs do. So the first new officer, I believe, needs to do a thorough size-up. After that, in most systems, now there's always going to be local issues and local concerns, and I respect that. And if it doesn't work where you are, God bless you, keep doing what you're doing or do it. You know, I'm just saying in most systems, I think we need to get away from this first due has to assume command so that the first due can stay with their company, go to work, and give good information to subsequent arriving units. Leave the command function to the command-level officer. In most systems that I'm aware of, someone is designated with the command function. Now, if they're also committed to a crew, that could be a difficulty. But in general, in most systems, there's somebody who the command function is delegated to. I say we leave it there. The reasons for it are, as I stated earlier, limited brain capacity under pressure, competing elements for our attention. So we talked a little bit earlier about situational awareness. Sizing something up is about being situationally aware. And what happens when we have things competing for our attention, our focus will narrow. You've always heard about people developing tunnel vision or people who describe being in a car accident and how things seem to narrow and their focus narrows. Well, that happens to some extent to a lot of people under pressure. We can start to alleviate that with simulation, but it's never going to completely eliminate that emotional activity that happens in a real event. And by a real event, I mean a real fire or a real emergency. You know, the classroom is the classroom. It's always going to be the classroom. The simulator is going to be the simulator. My son's a pilot. You know, he does very high fidelity simulations, but you still really learn how to fly, you know, when you get up in the air in a real aircraft, not in the simulator, as much value as simulators have. So on the fire ground, I think we need to start recognizing that there are limitations to what that first due officer can process and manage, and that their critical responsibility is to the crew that they rolled up in. And if they look at the fire and say, given the resources I have, my two or three people, I can make an effective difference right now in the growth or spread of this fire, then that lets you know that that's an offensive fire attack right there. They don't need to say it. They don't need to declare it. They don't need to say they're in command or tell anybody else anything. If I tell you I got a two-story residential, fire looks to be on the second floor, you know, we're throwing a ladder to the window and we're taking an inch and three-quarter up the interior stairwell, and you're the 72 officer, I mean, it ain't rocket surgery to know you're going to pull my backup line, right, Mike? Check my water supply and let me know you've got my back. That's where I want to move the fire service to, is what I'm calling now fire ground mental agility and supportive command. So in other words, rather than me as the first do telling you, saying, you know, command to engine two, when you arrive, pull a backup line, check my water supply, and you know, meet me on the interior. You tell me that. And by doing that, you're taking pressure off of me. Our goal should be to eliminate as many stressors as we can from the first do so that they can see more things and have more working memory. And so my new work today is trying to build fire ground mental agility by spreading the message of supportive command rather than isolated command, and that by eliminating or alleviating where possible the necessity of a first due officer from having to give directions to subsequent arriving units. Now, there's always caveats. There's always exceptions. You know, if the guy rolls or gal rolls up and she sees something and she says, wow, I've never seen this before. Hey, engine two, I want you to do this. Engine three, I want you to do that. That's absolutely fine. It's perfect. But those are anomaly situations. In 99.9% of what we go to, you know, after you've been around the block for a few years, you're pretty familiar with it. I mean, Mike, you and I could run a three-story walk-up in our sleep. We could go to a two-story residential all day long. We could, you know, standalone commercials, an assembly fire, what, you know, and it's not a stretch at this point in our careers. Younger officers, that's where it may be more of an issue. So if you look at it that way, some of our system is so dysfunctional that we could have the youngest, least experienced officer on the entire call assuming command and giving direction to more highly trained, highly skilled, more highly experienced officers who are subsequent arrivers. Wouldn't it be a better situation to have that first arriver look at a situation, use that RPD, say, this is what I see, this is what I think we've got, this is what I'm going to commit to with my crew, and then to have the rest of the officers respond to him saying, heard what you've got, Bobby, this is what I'm going to do for you, Bobby, this is how far out I am, anything else you're going to need from me? Or, hey, that sounds good, Bobby, keep going, got your back. Or, hey, have you looked around the back? Or, hey, I've been to that building before, and it's got a walk-through stairway, so the third and second floor are connected by a library stair, so the smoke or the fire can travel there. Nothing's going to stop it. You know, that kind of stuff, could be added. So that's where I am right now in fire ground decision making. It's really important that we continue to investigate, you know, how the mind works. And how we can help people to alleviate stress on the fire ground and be more cooperative and more supportive and have it be less directed and less, focused on one person.
I think that's great, Bobby, and I think that makes a lot of sense. And there are some takeaways that I get from that make me think it's a smarter plan. as you said, a lot of times the you know, Murphy's Law, so to speak, in the fire service, the first new officer is going to be the youngest, the newest promoted, and he might have the least experienced crew also. And that's a perfect storm because you're putting that crew in that building to start that line without their officer. You want that officer who saw it when he originally pulled up to be able to see if things are changing as he's going in that building. And I think leaving the command function, if he says what he has, gives his size up, the building, the dimensions, everything else, and we are starting to stretch the first line in through the front door, and then works with his crew because the officer supposedly is going to be the one making the decisions. And if he gets through the front door and something that he doesn't like is in there, he's going to be able to say, well, wait a second, we're going to slow down and reevaluate this. But a lot of places have the first officer assume command, stay on the front lawn, and then they let the crew start the line in there on their own. And I think that takes away from some of our crew safety, and we also could miss some of those key points.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that the key points being missed is crucial. The other thing is that when someone hits the limits of their working memory, they're in danger, and you can snap them right out of it with a little bit of support. But if you leave them in that position, they'll continue to go further and further and further inside themselves to where they'll shut down completely. And we've seen that in a few reports where it appears that that's what's happening to the people. It's pretty interesting stuff. And I think that now that we're talking about stuff like Blue Card and NIMS, I think that it's important that we continue to question boldly all of our assumptions. You know, people say, well, the first two have to assume command. Well, why? And all the time, really? Let's take the FDNY, Mike. You're rolling out a typical FDNY response, you know, three engines, two trucks, you know, a squad, a couple of chiefs. How fast is that chief, first chief, on the job 9 times out of 10?
Within a minute or two after the first in engine.
Yeah, so the first in engine doesn't assume command in the FDNY and start telling everybody else what to do they?
Absolutely not. But we also have solid SOGs in place that what the companies are going to do unless there's something unique about the situation. And that's where I think a lot of people get hung up in this, that they, if they don't have SOGs, if they don't have the plan in place, you can't use this because you need a plan. You need how you're going to fight this fire, and you need a basic plan. The first in engine is going to stretch a line. Whether you have a truck company, a dedicated truck company or not, someone's going to support ventilation outside the building. Someone's going to do searches. If you task your first in engine with doing the forcible entry, the search for fire, and I'm not even talking about the search for life, and stretching a hose line, and it's a 3 or 4 person engine, what happens? We have problems because there's too much work for them to get done and do anything well.
I agree. And I think that's why I'm saying not every organization can operate this way. But the problem becomes, might be the last group you designed is you got to hope that first in guy is the exception to the rule then in that organization. If you've got an organization where subsequent arrivers need to be given direction, how is it then that first arriver, if he's in that organization, is going to be any different?
Correct. And we have seen that numerous times where, you know, I love the story I heard one time of a guy that said the chief pulled up and said, okay, stretch a line. And they stretched a line to the front door. And then he said, how about putting some water in it and getting ready to fight the fire? Like, they wouldn't even charge a line without permission. You know, a good engine company, you'll see a fire, they'll know that their job is, they're the first in engine, we got to stretch a line. They'll stretch a line to where it's got to go, the right size line, have it charged and ready to go. And as soon as they say, okay, go, they go. But if you're going to wait, they're going to say, okay, when's the time where we're going to start telling them, okay, unbuckle your seatbelt, get off the fire truck, go to the rear of the fire truck? I mean, where do we stop that?
Well, I think, you know, again, it goes back to drill, and it goes back to, you know, fire ground discipline and fire ground excellence. And, you know, the more the competency we have, you know, I started off talking about driving a car. You know, if you have to think about pulling the hose load, then you haven't practiced enough. If you have to think about starting a saw, you haven't practiced enough. If you have to think about throwing a ladder, you haven't practiced enough. And I use the word practice. A lot of people like to use words like training and drill. And the problem with words like training and drill is that training to me is learning a new skill. You know, you train somebody how to do something, then they have to practice that to become proficient. And that's where we've kind of fallen down, Mike. You know, we have stopped. People say, well, we're bored, we've done it 100 times, you know what we're doing. Well, then we're going to do it 101, and we're going to do it 100. And, you know, it's like giving a good speech. You and I, you know, have the distinct honor of being asked to come and speak from time to time in different places. And I know you're just like me. You'll practice that speech and practice that speech until you think you're going to kill yourself if you have to hear yourself do it one more time. And that's the difference between, you know, caring about what you do and just showing up. And I think it's important to show up, and God bless people for showing up. But if you really care to make a difference and do it right, then you have to show up, but you have to show up with passion and dedication and purpose. And that comes from being practiced to a point to where making mistakes is the exception to in your behavior. You know, to where missing a cue would be an exception in your assessments.
I think that's an excellent point. I think that's an excellent point, because it's the old joke, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. And while we're talking about practice, Bobby, real quickly, we're going to hear from Granger one more time in our mid-conference interview, because that's who's paying.
With over 900,000 products and 31 diverse product categories, Granger is basically an anything you need supply buffet. We've got everything from safety and electrical products to hardware, hand tools, and more. So you can efficiently purchase exactly what you need from one source, saving time and trouble. And just to be sure, the buffet thing was a metaphor. Please don't eat the stuff. Buy your supplies smarter. Just call, click Grainger.com, or stop by a branch today. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to our ads. And we appreciate it, and we appreciate Granger's support. So I think all of this is very, very important to us, Bobby. And I think it's very, you know, it's because the basics, we're losing sight of the basics. And I was talking to a friend of mine on Facebook today, and he was saying that somebody said, you know, another tool for the toolbox. And his analogy was that the toolbox is getting so full, because we're throwing in all this other stuff, EMS skills, WMD skills, and everything else, that the basic tools are rusting in the bottom of the toolbox, and people are forgetting their basic skills.
And it's the old adage, jack of all trades and master of none.
Exactly. And I think the idea of this is bringing that skill of command and control of the first line back to the forefront.
I couldn't agree with you more. The first line at any fire is critical. And what's amazing to me, Mike, is that, you know, you and I both are blessed with being able to go around and do training seminars all over the country on the fire ground and fire ground decision making and everything else. And I often ask folks, what's the responsibility of the first new engine company? And invariably, I hear rescue. And I apologize to the audience, but I only have a few moments left. Wednesday's my drug day, and I'm on a strict schedule, so my wife is going to cut me off in about 3 minutes. But back in the 70s, there was a big push towards trying to teach tactical ground fire ground priorities, and they came up with an acronym called Chief REVOS. REVOS is rescue, evacuate. Well, way down, Mike, if you remember, in that list was extinguishment was like the last thing. You know what I mean? It was like way down there.
Yep.
And so when Mike and I came on in the 70s, the first due priority of a engine company was to locate fire, basically locate the fire and get a line on the – what's to extinguish it is to get a line on the first fire, you know, on the seat of the fire, as close to the seat of the fire as you could. Where the hell is the thing? Was the job of the first due engine company, find the fire. We got away from that, and suddenly it was all rescue, rescue, rescue. And I'll ask classes, and they'll say, well, the job of the first due is to perform a rescue. Well, sometimes there's not even anybody to rescue. So our priorities got screwed up. And then we came up with this command system to try to, you know, push these priorities into a perspective, and I think it got screwed up again. So now I think there's a renaissance of thought about tactics.
You still there? Did I lose you? Did I lose you, Bobby? Sorry, I'm losing you on the cell, bro. So what Bobby's talking about is we are losing the idea of the command. We are losing the idea of taking charge of this whole thing. And we are losing all of the ideas of doing it. And that idea with the rescues, to me, is just so amazing, because what happens is a lot of times people – yes, I'm here, Bobby.
Oh, good.
People will – you lost me for a minute. You faded out there. But what Chief Walton was talking about, what Bobby's talking about sometimes with this rescue, is people think that rescue is the engine company's first duty. And the problem is they'll put down a hand line to go make a rescue – and they will leave themselves and their brother and sister firefighters that are in that building exposed because they put down their weapon. The whole line is what puts out the fire. If you don't have a deal, if you're really stretching a line and you come upon a victim, you advance past the victim with the hose line, open it up, protect the other firemen, then you drop some people off the line or call for someone else to come in and make that rescue. But if you decide to put that line down, you are jeopardizing yourself, you are jeopardizing your brother and sister firefighters, and you're jeopardizing any other victims in that fire. Do you agree, Bob?
I agree with you completely, and I think that, you know, we've got to keep doing more homework on how the brain works under pressure, and I think we need to question everything we're doing and not throw out the hard lessons learned, but improve on them. And with that, I need to take my leave, Mike, and say thank you for allowing me to be on, and I appreciate it greatly, and I hope I get to visit with you again soon on your show and elsewhere. But I want to thank you very much for having me.
No problem, Bobby. Tell Marsha I said hello, and I will keep you informed on how Mike G's dad is doing if I get any more information. I love you, man. Be well, and I will talk to you in the next day or two.
Okay, Michael. Take care. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Bye-bye. So, folks, we're going to continue on for a couple more minutes going through some of this critical decision-making stuff and just some of the stuff about what we want. Most of us are doing it, and the Marine Corps used to have a term called the Marine Corps School of Management, and what the Marines used to say is that what you do is you bring out a plan immediately. It might be imperfect, but you roll out the imperfect plan at a time when you can. If it's wrong, you adapt and overcome. The problem that I think a lot of us have in fire service now is we're trying to come up with a perfect plan, a plan for every fire. Unfortunately, we can't come up with that plan. We can't come up with that ideas. And one of the questions that was asked in our chat is by Mike in Anne Arundel is, the county requires at least the second arriving unit to take command, okay? Some of your units might only have a pump operator and an officer as normal staffing, and I do understand that. And it's a good thing that the second thing was taken. The pump operator can either, if the original pump operator is operating the pump, he can put on his gear and follow the line in to assist the other company as long as they're advised that he's coming in. And the second arriving officer can take command.
But we have to have an idea of what we are doing here. And again, that's that plan. That's the SOGs. That's the basic thing that we have going on here. And again, the things are critical decision making is understanding that there are decisions that have to be made in the fire, at the fire, and understanding what the decisions are going to be based on and what the time is going to be about, and understanding how that works for all of us. It's not an easy skill. It's a learned skill. And a very, very good friend of mine used to say that a wise man learns from his experience. A wise man learns from the experience of others. And I always loved that line because we learn about things as we go through the fire service from listening to other people about fires they've had. That's why firefighters love to tell fire stories. It's because they're fires that are etched in their memory. They're things that have gone on. They're things that have been problems for them. So what I want to make all of you remember and think about is in making these decisions in the fire ground, I mean, we talk about situational awareness. We talk about size up, okay? To me, they're a little different. Size up is sizing up the building, understanding the building, understanding what's going on. Situational awareness is different because situational awareness is understanding the situation we put ourselves in. You go to a fire on any given day. You could be the RIT team. You could be the first in engine. You could be the second in engine. You could have a water supply. You could have ventilation. You could have the roof. You could have rescue. You could be anything, and the situational awareness is understanding the situation where that is there. And also situational awareness in a fire situation is seeing everything that's going on around you, paying attention and reevaluating. And also, to me, situational awareness is knowing your crew. We get on a fire truck, and myself included, we all have good days and bad days. Sometimes we have a bad day. My partner, and again, I ask anybody listening out there, say a little prayer for Mike Galliano's dad. He fell off a ladder yesterday, and he's banged up pretty good. But we have people who could be dealing with problems at home, family problems, our parents, a sick child, a sick spouse, someone who's going through the breakup of a relationship, a marriage breaking up, or something else. All these things affect people. And if they're already under stress coming into work, and then we put them under stress in a fire situation, that's going to be a little different. I have seen people, and I have been to places where people have had come into work and they were out a little late last night. And I did it myself when I was a young gun fireman. And maybe it wasn't the smartest thing to do, but now that person is going to be a weaker link in your company, in your crew, on your day to day. So pay attention to that because that is your situational awareness. That is where you find out what exactly is going on with that crew. Size up the building. Know the buildings. Know what's going on in your area. But also know the situation. And that situation means you have to be involved with the men and women you work with. And if you are working for just a day, just a tour, or volunteering, and there's someone new in the company, meet the person, learn about the person, and talk to the person and find out about them. So those are some of the things that we talk about when we talk about our critical decision making. And they're important to each and every one of us because making good decisions on the fire ground lead to positive events, okay? So I think I've got a caller here. Give me a half a second to check out who this is, and I'll get right back to you. Hi, folks. Joining us tonight, Mike Galliano is coming in with us right now. First off, bro, how's it going? How's your dad doing?
He's doing okay. He isn't a firefighter, but he's a firefighter at heart. He doesn't let the fact that he's
71, keep him off of a ladder. And unfortunately, my mom came home from the gym and found him in quite a pool of his own blood, and he'd fallen off the ladder and cracked his skull, and you know, the whole nine yards. So great job by the good folks at Marysville Fire. I'm fortunate that my parents are served by an amazing, wonderful fire department, and they came in, got him to the hospital, and he's got a basilar skull fracture, and you know, all the multiple concussions. And, but he's talking to us, and he's honoring, and you know, the head bleed hasn't progressed any further. So we're just grateful for that, and thankful for, you know, the great firefighters who helped out, and all your prayers. I appreciate it, bro. I'm just mom's doing the night shift, and I'm doing the day shift at the hospital. So sometimes you just gotta, when life starts throwing you into the whirlwind, you just gotta hang on. So right now we're just hanging on, buddy.
Yeah, I guess you've got a good run. Mike just got back to work, and his first throw back from a pretty significant back injury. His rig was rear-ended, so very interesting.
Yeah, 15 minutes from the firehouse. 15 minutes from the firehouse. First shift back, and a five-month pregnant little gal looking at her cell phone plowed into the back of me. So, like I said, sometimes you just got to hold on, Michael, right?
Yep. Sometimes you just got to hold on. Listen, I'm supposed to go to Jersey tomorrow to do an officer's leadership class. And we're having a nor'easter tonight, expecting 60-mile-an-hour winds, possibly snow today, tomorrow, tonight. Seems like I can't get out of Long Island anymore with the weather, because the last time I was supposed to go somewhere with Mike, it was in February 8th and 9th. Supposed to be in Minnesota, and we had just the snow. So it was a very, very interesting time here on Long Island.
Yeah, you guys are getting a ton of nor'easters, man. It's like, holy smokes.
Yep, we're just in the pattern. Classic nor'easters, 60, 70-mile-an-hour winds, heavy, heavy surf. I was down at the Long Island Sound, which is between the North Shore of Long Island and Connecticut, and there were probably four-footers on the Sound today at about 2 o'clock. Very, very impressive. I mean, I was thinking I could probably go out there on a surfboard. You know, I was kind of wishing I had a wetsuit and a kayak. I could have had a lot of fun.
Well, I'm sorry that I missed Bobby. I caught just the tail end of it. I think you said he had to take off, but I'm sure the discussion was wonderful. And boy, there's no better topic, you know, than as he likes to describe it. I'm sure he used the term mental agility on the fire ground.
Yep. Yeah, mental agility, and we talked about how we're losing focus of some of the basics in all of our stuff. So, yeah, it went very, very well. It was very interesting. We had a couple of questions in the chat room and just about what's going on. But the problem, and it's something that Bobby and I did spend a little time on, is they're just giving us too much to do, you know, and paying attention to it. It's amazing.
Yeah, I'm working on a little piece right now. I don't have it completely fleshed out, but where the, you know, there's nothing groundbreaking. I don't think there's anything new under the sun. But I was listening to a discussion that Pete Carroll, the head coach of the Seahawks, was having about bringing in the new players, the new football players, and how if they overwhelm them too quick, if they give them too much too quick, they play slow. He described it as playing slow because they're thinking so much about the things that they're trying to do, and they're thinking about all the rules and all the calls and all the audibles and all this stuff. And, you know, I think it translates over just amazingly well to the fire service, because they're giving us, you know, or the information that we're getting now is so expansive. I mean, from the scientific studies being done by UL, the stuff that's being done in other countries, the toolbox that you have from 20, 30 years of doing the job. And you know, now you try to throw all that at somebody who's newer, or even guys like us, Mike, you know, trying to keep up with what's true now versus what was true 20 years ago. And all of a sudden, all this information can cause you to look at something that isn't necessarily all that complex, you know, a basic house fire or a basic little commercial or a taxpayer or whatever, you know, whatever, grinder out on the freeway. And all of a sudden you're trying to think of, okay, so what was this rule and what was this new thing? You know, and pretty soon you start playing slow because you're having to process more of what were the rules, what were the new ideas versus here's the game plan and here's the way to tackle things and here's how we practice, how we're going to go about this. And then we adapt to the changing data. And that's where you start to, I think, start to play fast, you know, and start to make quick critical decisions instead of just almost being overwhelmed and, you know, you kind of go into a fugue state of kind of paralysis by analysis. And so that's the thing that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about, Mike, just because there's so much data out there, you know, and so many tools and so many new studies, you know, what we used to do isn't good and now we should do this. And, you know, just trying to process it all and go put out the dog on fire, right?
Yeah, I agree with you 100%, and I also think that the other thing that we're seeing a lot of in the fire service is people who are afraid to make a mistake because everybody's watching on video, on cell phone cameras, on security cameras and everything else. Listen, if I had a dollar for every mistake I made in the fire service, I would own my own island in the Caribbean somewhere, okay? And, I mean, if you don't make a mistake, you're not trying.
Yeah.
And I understand critical decision-making and all of it is part of it, but if you don't step up, if you don't step up to do something, you don't mess up. And if you don't mess up, you're not learning, okay? You're just kind of staying there waiting for someone else to make the choice for you. And what we want is thinking firemen who are willing to step up and to mess up.
Yeah, well, and I know some of the decisions that, you know, maybe came harder lessons learned in life for me came during those times when I wasn't doing, you know, I did make mistakes, and you just never really forget those. It's entrenched so much in your mind, and I typically made those mistakes when I was put in a position to make them. If you're just hanging back and you're not doing anything, you know, you're not putting yourself out there, you're not trying to get better, you're not putting yourself in a command position or in a training position where you're challenging yourself, of course you're not going to make mistakes. You know, the only mistake you're going to make is, you know, which TV channel to push while you're sitting in the recliner. The stuff that really sticks with me are the times when I put myself out. And, you know, I was the first one to volunteer for the drill, even though, you know, it's better to watch two or three people do it, and then you can kind of learn from what they're doing. I said, man, screw that. Let me be the first guy out, and I'll go and make my mistakes, and I'll... You remember that stuff so clearly. I know there's a, I don't know the name of the study, but we had put it in our book a while back. There's a study about training and drilling and practicing before the big event under stress. And typically, if you will put yourself under stress, if you will add a stress component, you learn so much more from the drill as related to how it's going to be when you're out there practically versus just doing basic drills with no stress didn't provide the same level of learning. So, man, you know, gang, those of you who are listening, you know, you're change agents, man. You got talents, you got stuff that God gave you in the fire service. Put it to use, man, and make us better, and make your department better. And don't worry about the guy on the sideline taking pot shots or the gal, you know, in the beer room, you know, saying, who do you think you are? Let me tell you who you are. You're part of the National Fire Service, and we need you. And get out there and make us better for you.
Amen, brother. Amen. You are breaking up quite a bit, just so you know.
Okay. Okay, Mike. Well, I'll tell you what. I gotta get back to my pop anyway, but I just wanted to call in and say hey to everybody, and my apologies for not being able to be there, and appreciate your prayers for my family.
And good luck, and tell your dad we said hi and cherish him. I wish I had mine. He was gone 5 years, March 1st. So cherish your dad, and, you know, listen, I hope I'm the only old goat at 71 climbing a ladder, and, you know, more power to him.
Yeah. All right, Mike, you take care, brother.
All right, God bless, bro.
Okay, bye-bye.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we have heard from Bobby Halton. I have talked to my buddy Mike Galliano about this, and we will wrap it up. I think what you, as the men and women who have listened to us across the board in fire engineering land,
what you need to take away from our talk about this skill and why it's important on the fire ground is you need to make a decision. You need to step up, make the decision. It's not always going to be right. It's not always going to be correct. But you need to think about what you're going to do, what's the priority, and how you're going to do that. And do it and go for it. Don't be a person who's not willing to change. Don't get stuck in that this is what I'm doing and I'm the only one who can do it. But please do it. We're going to hear from our last thing from Rangers and then close out right after that.
Running a facility, chances are managing inventory isn't your favorite part of the day. Stocking and tracking, ordering and organizing, all necessary evils eating up your time. That's why Grainger's KeepStock services help you manage your inventory more efficiently, from basic labeling and scanning to secure dispensing machines, putting you in total control, often allowing you to buy less, making things seem, well, not so evil anymore. Contact your Grainger representative or visit Grainger.com/KeepStock today. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, I thank you for listening to me. I thank you for listening to my buddy Mikey. I thank you for being here to listen to Bobby Walton. As always, if you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us at Facebook at Mikey G. And Mikey B on Facebook. You can find us in the fire engineering training community in This House Rocks, or individually as Mike Galliano and Mike Dugan. Or you can also find us on Facebook. So please feel free to reach out and grab us. And you can also reach us at Mikey G and Mikey B at AOL.com. Any questions, please feel free to drop us a line. Thank you all for listening. God bless you, and be well, and we'll talk to you.